From WXXI News, it's Connections Education Friday. I'm Frank Sigelski. Coming up on this hour of Connections Education Friday, first we're going to sit down and talk about the Rochester City School District. The school board last night approved its $788 million budget. We have Chief of Staff Patricia Malgeri here, and also Bill Ansbro. He's the Chief Financial Officer, and we'll get right to that in a minute. And then at 1:30 to 2 o'clock, we have Alice Carley from the Eastman School of Music, Sibley Library, and she's going to talk about preservation of music and musical scores and all things like that. But let's get into the school district budget, and welcome back to Connections. You've been on before, and you know the drill, so I'll start with the Chief of Staff, and opening statement, please.
Well, you have us on at the exact right time. A lot of exciting things are happening in the Rochester City School District. As you mentioned last night, our budget was adopted unanimously by the Board of Education, and they also passed a resolution relating to the future of East High School, whereby they unanimously chose University of Rochester as a potential educational partnership organization to manage the East High campus.
Right. We're going to go into a little more detail in that because that is fascinating. What are some of the line items? Bill Ansbro, the Chief Financial Officer. Surprises, last-minute changes. There were a couple. Can you give us the numbers, the highlights?
Well, there were some changes, but overall, you know, the board was very supportive of the superintendent's proposal. And I think, you know, what's very encouraging about this budget is this upcoming year, about 90% of our pre-K children are going to get full-day pre-K versus 30% last year. So the whole notion that the superintendent consistently talks about the importance of getting our children to read by third grade, that's an important part of his strategy. So the superintendent prepared this budget not only trying to close the $42 million budget gap, but also trying to drive investments that are actually going to make our schools attractive and, you know, where our children can learn.
Sure. I think most folks agree that you spend the money when they're young and it pays dividends for the rest of their educational career and life, and full-day kindergarten. It just always, as a parent, it never made sense, the half-day. By the time you get them there, they get their coats off and, you know, they have their orange juice or whatever it is they do. And I forgot, it's been a long time. They're almost ready to go home again. And then you got the commuting and all that. So that's a good thing. Obviously, there are going to be some critics, and I know you're anticipating that. And so we'll go back to the Chief of Staff. What are your concerns regarding some of the criticisms? Because this has been out there for quite a while. There have been a lot of public hearings.
Right. I think one of the important things that we're trying to do in this budget, and it does raise some questions, is we're really trying to redefine what prevention means in the Rochester City School District. For the recent history, we were more of a district that focused money on retention of students and intervention after the fact. And as you mentioned, we're really trying to invest heavily in preventing problems. And you'll see in the budget there is a lot of investment in art, music, extracurricular activities, sports. And some people think that maybe we should continue to put more money into what we call social-emotional interventions. So we're trying to do both, but definitely you'll see more of an increase in those enhancements to students' lives. We're really trying to give our students the same kind of advantages that a middle-class student would have in a suburban district. And that's a change in philosophy and culture in the Rochester City School District, and it really does require some investment.
Right, right. If you're going to change the policies, you've got to change the way it's paid for. And there were some places where there were cuts of teachers. What can you tell us about that, Bill?
Well, I think, you know, at a high level, you know, overall we're proposing our workforce contract about 3.5%, but that really just mirrors our projected enrollment decline. So we're just trying to be fiscally responsible, have to align our staffing and our workforce, you know, to meet the needs of our students. And by doing that, at the same time, that allows us to have those funds to invest in those priorities that will make our district better in the future.
Okay. Again, our guest for this the half hour of the hour, we have Patricia Malgeri. She's the Chief of Staff of the City School District, and Bill Ansbro is the Chief Financial Officer. If you want to join the show, the number is 1-844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. The old numbers still work, but that'll be changing, 263-9994, 263-WXXI. All right, let's talk a bit about the U of R thing, because I think a lot of people are interested in that because it's new for this area, at least.
Mm-hmm. To remind people, the New York State Education Department informed us that we needed to submit a plan to them by May 15th about the future of East High because, unfortunately, despite some extra funding over the last few years and focused attention, we have not been successful in reaching academic goals that are sufficient for the state to feel comfortable. So they gave us five options, including closing the building totally and relocating all the students, which, of course, we did not choose to do. One of the options was to convert to a charter school or to have one of the SUNY schools manage the building, and none of those came to fruition. So we really ended up focusing on two, one of which is to contract with an educational partnership organization. That's an organization that has a track record in managing schools, and certainly University of Rochester does that. The other was, in case we didn't get an educational partnership organization to reply, we also had to prepare a phase-in, phase-out plan. We did get one other educational partnership organization, one that actually went through the RFP process and submitted an application. The board chose not to act on that one. That was an organization in the Albany area. And so instead, the University of Rochester did not go through the RFP process, but had discussions with members of our board and people in the community. And so we submitted the phase-in, phase-out plan to the board just in case.
Plan B.
Meanwhile, yes, the board had conversations with the University of Rochester. So where we are now is that, as we said last night, the board voted unanimously to move forward with just the University of Rochester as a potential educational partnership organization. We are awaiting response from the State Education Department as to whether that constitutes what they were requiring us to do by May 15th. We're hopeful of getting some response from State Ed on whether that did comply, because it's raising some questions about whether that was enough and what does it mean for who manages the campus now, and whether we can continue to take in students in seventh grade, or whether we might need to phase out those incoming students. So we're hopeful of getting that answer from the State Education Department very soon.
Right. But it sounds like maybe you needed a little additional time, not anticipating that the other EPO wouldn't be something that you would want to pursue. In terms of what happened last night, is it a matter of voting on just funding exploratory talks, as opposed to the policy decision was made?
Right. What the resolution that was passed by the board said is that they are asking for a year's extension, and that immediately the University of Rochester would begin to help plan a transformed educational environment on the campus. And so there would be a transition year if State Ed complies or agrees to this, and that University of Rochester would formally submit an educational partnership application by December and hopefully be chosen in their mind. But yes, this is a different response than the State Ed Department was probably expecting. It did emerge fairly late, so we're needing that clarification.
Well, it sounds very promising. Mm-hmm. I think it's certainly something worth exploring, and it's unfortunate that you only have so much time to respond to the department.
Right, and what we do want to say is that early on in the process, when we were assuming that some of our schools might be in this situation, the superintendent did reach out to the University of Rochester and other colleges. You might remember about 6 months ago, I was on the show and we were talking about that. So we very much think of education organizations at the universities as being examples of organizations that have proven they can manage schools.
All right. And what was approved? There was a letter written to John King from the president of the U of R, Joel Seligman, outlining the proposal. It was a letter of intent dated May 6th, 2014. Is that the document that we're still most – is that the –
Right.
most recent thing that we're talking about here?
Right. There was a resolution last night passed that references that letter. So the board had to take an official action, and that's in the form of a resolution, but they reflect back on that letter and reference it. So what they're saying is they would the board is asking State Ed to accept that letter, provide the extension, let University of Rochester actually submit a formal EPO application, because that letter doesn't constitute a plan, most likely in the minds of State Ed.
Okay, let's go to Bill. Bill Ansbro, he's the chief financial officer of the City School District. In terms of the numbers to explore this, like, what are the? At the end of the day, whether you're making a proposal or looking at a proposal or reaching an agreement, who's going to be spending what on what? And can you give us any ideas to where we might be going with that?
Well, that's a significant uncertainty. You know, we have about 1,700 kids students that are there. So we're going to have to, you know, continuously be very engaged and be, you know, cost these different options out. And I think as these situations become clearer, they're going to have to be mindful about, you know, how do we stay within our overall budget. But certainly, it's new ground for us, and we're going to have to take it one step at a time.
And ultimately, you'll get to line item expenditures to fulfill your obligations underneath an agreement if you get to an agreement with the U of R, and I guess the Education Department has to sign off on it, right? They're driving this bus, aren't they?
Right. One of the changes we did make in the budget last night was to put in $1 million, right, Bill, for those planning activities during the next year. Or the first year of an EPO, whatever the board ended up acting on last night. So whether $1 million will be enough, we'll have to continue to analyze.
We also included funds for, you know, a number of our children at East to attend BOCES if they choose to. So that was part of our budget plan as well. And that was one of the requirements that SED put forward.
Okay. All right. And interesting, the letter says talks about the budget neutrality principle. So I guess that's sort of a guiding goal. Good luck. I'm just going to say good luck right now to our chief financial officer here, because I think that's where the fun's going to be.
Well, that means budget neutrality for the University of Rochester,
right?
For the Rochester City School District.
Exactly. It's like, well, just they want the ground rules clear up front, I guess is what they're saying there. So, okay. What other highlights in terms of the budget, and what is the next step here in terms of it goes to the city government now, right?
Yeah, one thing I don't know if Patty mentioned or not, but the superintendent also included in his budget enhancements in athletics. So there's going to be four new modified football teams as well. So that's important to kind of build the programs. It's also part of that social-emotional started at a younger age.
Mm-hmm.
So that's part of that. And also as part of that, we plan on basically having scholarships for volunteer coaches to become certified, because it's actually very expensive to get certified. So the idea is we're going to try to engage the community, bring in some more assistant coaches to volunteer to help build the program.
That's great. Leverage your investment.
Yes,
that's another example of that.
Exactly. So so the next step is next week we have to send the budget over to the City of Rochester, and then they'll deliberate on it. There's a public hearing on June 11th, and then ultimately the city will adopt their budget on June 17th. So that's the timeline, and City Council also has a special hearing just on the school budget, and that also that'll also occur in on May 22nd.
Okay, so and again the modified sports that starts in sixth grade. Okay, again, I saw you writing furiously there.
Well, because I never want to forget, or the superintendent would kill us. We have more money in the budget for more reading teachers. And we are investing heavily in summer learning. If he were here, he would say we've got to stem summer learning loss.
Mm-hmm.
He's all about relying on data and research to drive our decision-making and priorities. And we know money spent during the summer means that children won't backtrack in their learning and lose what they learned the year before. So are really looking forward to adding to the number of students who are going to summer school, not just traditional summer school at the high school level, but programs for children as young as kindergarten. So we're determined to have every student from kindergarten to third touched in some way by a summer learning opportunity.
Okay,
and the superintendent's actually done it in a number of different ways, just not the traditional model with the schools. It's actually partnered with another of organizations as well as the library. So six libraries are also going to offer summer camps as well. So the whole idea is trying to make it accessible.
Right, right. So it's sort of seamless. You're learning year-round, lifelong learner. Shall we go to the phones? We have Bonnie. Bonnie in Fairport, welcome to Connections, Education Friday.
Oh, well, it's Bonnie in Rochester. okay, yeah, I was just wondering with the U of R proposal and all that. You probably will recall, I don't know, it's been maybe now a couple of months ago, that Van White from the board, kind of called to order a broad-based community meetings in which there was different topics, parent involvement, racism, and a whole bunch of them. that then there were, you know, groups of people interested in the community, parents, et cetera, got together in each of these categories and kind of developed a plan. That was before the notice of East High came to fruition. And then I think after that happened, there had been some talk about taking those principles, which were had a lot of real solid work done with them, and using them to either do an EPO, that would be maybe the ideal. But I guess my question now is, you know, and this gets to a general question of community and other and parents and et cetera involvement again, and that, or a strong involvement, not just the word involvement, but so in terms of how the U of R or how accountable are they going to be for these kind of things, and is the superintendent did not really take up on these things very much in terms of how I see it, but is that kind of work that was really important work, is that going to be officially factored into what the U of R may end up doing, even though it's vague in places, yeah. But is that going to just sit on a table someplace? Or,
thanks for the call. We appreciate you got a lot there, and let's let the experts answer that. You got a lot of good questions, though.
What I can say is that if the board president were here, I'm sure he would say, as he did last night, that the changes, that the modifications to the proposed budget that were made by the Board of Ed last night did reflect the input that they received from those very committees that you're mentioning. So that's where you should look, is in the Appendix B in the budget, where they actually made changes that they pegged to that input from the committees. And I'm sure that the ongoing conversations that the board president and the other members of the board will have with the University of Rochester over the next year will be driven by those very factors that they felt were important coming out of those committees.
Right. Still a lot to be learned. Bill, anything you'd like to add to that?
No, I think just, you know, the caller's question was specifically, you know, around the U of R, but philosophically, the superintendent is extremely committed to engagement. He holds monthly community coffee and conversation sessions. During the budget process, we had over 200 people involved, 6 different opportunities, and we try to integrate those ideas into our budget, you know, specifically. And the parents, really, they consistently talk about how they appreciate the increased investment in art, music, sport, you know, making those attractive places for their kids to attend.
Okay, what other are there other types of like outreach programs? You know, you have the pencil partnerships, and what are some trends in that area? Again, maybe to help leverage and also to build that community, that sense of community.
Well, this year we've been really excited to have 33 AmeriCorps volunteers who are in our schools specifically relating to our expanded day and extended day programs in schools. And those activities involve a lot of community partners and volunteers. Free Partnerships, for example, is an umbrella agency that helps to bring in everyone from faith communities to individuals who are interested in reading to our children and tutoring them. Nydia Padilla is in charge of Padilla Rodriguez is in charge of our volunteer efforts in that regard, and we want to grow that very aggressively. So the more people who are willing to help us in the schools doing everything from tutoring to helping children do field trips, et cetera, we would love those additional folks to step up to the plate.
Those volunteer opportunities are very rewarding personally. I know in the past I've done it in my lunch hour. And when you see the child's growth during that time frame, it's very rewarding.
That's fantastic. Now, you know, you've piqued my interest with this concept of for coaches, getting scholarships to help them get certified and making it easier, more of a partnership concept. Do you see that? I mean, is that a trend that we should be looking for and be thinking about? Sort of, you know, let's work. We need the support of people, not just people who are on the staff. Not just the teachers, but the whole community, and we're going to show you that we're all in. We've got something that for you as well, because we know it's a big commitment to do it right.
Absolutely, I think for us to be successful, we need to have everybody engaged, and the more people engaged, you know, the better off our students are going to be. And from a financial perspective, obviously, you know, leveraging other resources helps significantly.
Are there other expenses that you or things that other things that you can do to help those who are volunteering? Transportation stipends. I don't know. This is your area.
One area that I love to talk about is Rochester Education Foundation. That's been a link to us for many years, and Rochester Children's Scholarship Fund. They're two of our partner agencies that help to raise money to be distributed to either our children specifically in the form of scholarships, to things like helping people to donate used or new musical instruments, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
We want our kids to have what middle class kids have, and sometimes that requires us to reach out and have people donate.
Help out with that.
Yes.
What about like in the area of technology? And that's another thing that I know it's expensive, and to be without access to the electronic world it's just you can't compete.
Well, actually, that is one area that we feel we are very well placed and probably at the head of any district.
Head of the class.
Yes, we're head of the class because we have smart boards in every classroom now. And we have many students who have access to iPads and other things that are putting us in a much better place to have them do work at home, for instance, that they used to have to do only in class. So we do invest heavily with the help of federal and state money and foundations as well. So I think we're well placed there. But you can always students want that technology one-on-one, and we're trying to do that one equipment for each student. We're moving in that direction.
Yeah, this budget actually includes $2.2 million of an additional investment funded by our Microsoft settlement that was part of a national issue. So we're fortunate to benefit from that. So that's going to refresh some of the technology specifically in the schools that the kids are going to touch every day.
Okay, so two words, Internet Explorer, well, three words, and Heartbleed. Okay, so there you go. There you know. That's the new stuff. But what about, speaking of community outreach, we just have a minute or two left, the Latino Studies Department. I would imagine that's another what happened with that?
That's actually an example of what the previous caller was asking about.
Right,
so
right.
That emerged from the input that the Board of Ed received from the community. That was, I think, to respond to the caller, the board would say that was a direct request on the part of many people in the community.
Mm-hmm. All right. We have about a minute left. Are there other things? Is there anything, if someone were to scrutinize the numbers, they might have questions, and financial statements always have notes. But, Bill, I'll give you a chance. Is there anything that you might think someone looking at it might think is kind of strange?
No, I think the only thing I just wanted to mention, philosophically, one of the things we're trying to do, too, is partner with the city on different win-win opportunities. So, partnering with them in the libraries is one opportunity. But we also not only doing that on the program side, but also on the physical side. So this year when the Highland Library, actually we're punching out a wall to share space, so the Highland Library will be able to, use the same computer lab that's connected to our School 12. So we're just being very deliberate about trying to partner and leverage opportunities.
Well, especially with the city, and, obviously if the city has its eyes on your jobs or whatever, and it's for the greater good, that's what we should assume. That's what I choose to assume. And so are there other things that in your dealings with the city that you want them to be especially aware of?
Well, we always say we share families, taxpayers, and the physical location, same blueprint, same footprint. So we do participate in three-on-three conversations, staff to staff, legislator to legislator, and we're always looking for those opportunities. So the fact that Bill and I used to work in the city does help, I think, too. We know people over there that are willing to come to the table as well.
Well, fantastic, and good luck, and keep up the good work. That's Patty Malgieri. She's chief of staff of the City School District, and the chief financial officer is here as well, Bill Ansbrough. Thank you both very much, and we'll look forward to hearing more about it in the future.
Thank you.
All righty. You are listening to Connections Education Friday. I'm Frank Sigelski. Coming up, we're going to talk about preservation of musical scores with Alice Carley of the Eastman School of Music, Sibley Library. So stay tuned. It's Connections Education Friday. I'm Frank Sigelski. It's WXXI AM and WXXI.org.
I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on the next Connections, the struggles and success of a local baking star. Heather Saffer's cupcakes won a national competition, but she's opened up about an eating disorder and her own doubt about promoting an unhealthy product. She explains the lessons she's learned. And we'll dig into the Bills draft with journalist Scott Petoniak, with the NFL commissioner telling Buffalo the city will have to build a new stadium to keep the franchise. That's Monday on Connections.
And continuing on Connections Education Friday, for the next half hour, we're going to visit with Alice Carley. She is, well, she's got quite a resume. I did a little more digging last night, Alice, and I found that you're a published author of a book that's cited in a lot of prestigious publications, which makes sense because you're right in the middle of a very professional, good career in music, and you work at the Eastman School of Music, Sibley Library, Conservator.
Yeah, it's a great place to work. It's a fun job.
Okay, well, let's say, what is a job description? I mean, I know kind of, but, you know.
Yeah. My job is to keep the paper scores at Sibley Library usable one way or another for an indefinitely long period.
Okay, right off the bat, I'm going to think, why don't you just digitize them?
In fact, we do. It's hard to play a string quartet off a computer file, so that we have other things to think about as well.
And I assume there's sort of a museum issue here as well. You have the original scores,
yes,
written in the pen of...
We do. In some ways, the specialty of Sibley is less manuscripts, although we have some in the vault, than it is other early, and when I say early prints, when Sibley started in the 1920s, think about the economy of that time.
Roaring.
20s, it was roaring, and then you know, the Depression hit. And meanwhile, in Europe, it wasn't even that roaring in the 20s. It was so that when the first librarian, Barbara Duncan, was traveling in Europe from the 20s through the 40s with money from George Eastman and Hiram Sibley, who just said, buy everything.
Wow.
It was fabulous. She got just troves of music that she brought back and that we have on the shelves, so that there is a lot of music that was in our just general collections out there on the shelf.
You're talking about the written in the copies.
We're talking about copies.
Okay. All right,
but they're copies of, you know, little Russian, not even so little, they were big Russian publishers that don't exist anymore, and a whole lot of little European publishers that don't
right.
exist anymore, and they sold 20 copies back in 1922, and of those 20 copies, 19 of them got lost, discarded, went brittle, or whatever, and then Sibley has one.
Wow. Okay, so big responsibility.
Yeah.
Like, you're not allowed to bring coffee into that room.
Well, I'll tell you, this isn't in the vault. This is throughout the entire first floor of the library where everybody can walk around. We try not to let people bring coffee, but...
Chinese food?
Yeah. So that one piece of the conservation problem is dealing with the fact that for so long we had music that was literally rare, but was not, in fact, there was so much of it we couldn't fit it in the vault.
And you couldn't protect it. And you have
right.
these, really, they're treasures with each and every passing year, and they're still out in the general stacks?
Most of them actually aren't any longer because of a big digitization project that we did do. In the 1980s, we started a conservation program, and we had a well-known conservator of the time, George Cunha, come and take a look at the collection and what we were already doing. My predecessor as conservator, Ted Honey, started mm-hmm. this with Mary Davidson, who was the head librarian mm-hmm.
back
at the
in the
time,
80s.
In the 80s. And George Cunha said he had seldom seen a nascent conservation project that was being so well organized, but had never seen
wow.
a challenge as great as what we had. More than half of the collection was brittle, 57%. And if you think about how you use music, when you read a book, you read a page, you turn the page. You read the next page, you turn the page. When you're using a piece of music, it isn't like that. you read a page, you turn the page, you turn it back again. You're studying a movement.
And back and forth with the sheet mm-hmm. music on the stand.
And I remember what I used to do when I was young and frustrated over that particularly difficult passage. And I'm glad that I wasn't using Riddle Music at that time.
Oh, my God. Too funny.
Yeah.
Did you come across any, let's just say, revisions when you were, in other mm-hmm. words, when you were starting this process or when they were mm-hmm. starting it? Did they find sheet music that had been changed by... Not changed, but marked up. I mean, with some of it, like, not vandalized, but you know what I mean? Because I would think you would want mm-hmm. to make a note to yourself, like, take a deep breath before you play this passage.
There's three kinds of markings that we come across. One kind is the kind that was made, like, by the composer or by some early person playing the piece of music and saying, this is how you should do it. It's that has obvious historical importance. We put those in the vault if we can figure out what they are.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the problem, of course, is that, you know, the composer doesn't always sign it. The first important performer doesn't always say who they are. Then we also have the next kind, which is the kinds of markings made by professors for students or when they are preparing the pieces themselves for recitals. Now, they shouldn't be doing this with library music, mm-hmm. I will note. In particular, if you want a marking to stay in a piece of music, don't mark your library score, because you know when you turn it in, we're going to erase it, because we assume that most of the markings made in library scores are the third kind, made by students, which consist of circling every dynamic marking and writing that little picture of eyeglasses that tell you where you have to look at the conductor. And writing, slow down for somebody to catch up, all that kind of stuff, which is very useful for the person using that music who made the markings, but is really annoying for the next person who wants to use that music. So that part of what we do as librarians is erase those markings. If this was an orchestra library, that would be a whole different matter, but it isn't.
Oh, that's too funny. I mean, just the things that come up on the show, it's amazing. And this is really interesting. If you want to join the show, the number is 1-844-295-TALK, 1-844-295-TALK. That's 8255. I have to slow down because we're just getting this number out there. Alice Carley is here, and she is from the Sibley Music Library at the Eastman School of Music. In terms of determining if marking on a sheet music is, you know, actually as old as you might think it, do you ever analyze the ink? Because don't they put something in the in ink? The manufacturers have agreed to put something in ink so you can tell if something was made after a certain date because it has some marker.
I actually wouldn't know, because that probably most of the markings in most of the music that we have would post-date things like iron gall ink and other identifiable inks. That's what you would be looking at in a rare books situation. And I'm not actually a rare books conservator.
But you've been dealing with really rare books.
Yes.
But you're getting them in to their proper place.
One of the interesting things that we noticed in our digitization program is that with a lot of that rare music, it was totally unmarked. In fact, had often never left our shelves because it was rare enough that nobody had ever heard of that composer or that piece of music. So they just didn't get around to cracking it open to see if it was any good or not.
Interesting. Interesting. Do you use Post-it notes? Do people use that now? Post-it notes. You know, the little stickies, these things.
Yeah. For what?
For marking up their music.
Oh, no. I don't. Because, of course, the Post-it note would cover up whatever you were wanting to mark. If you think about it, if you're wanting to, you know, like I say, if you're wanting to put in measure numbers or circle the little dynamic markings, the Post-it note definitely wouldn't work.
Yeah, it's not as satisfying either.
Yeah.
Okay, so what's the first thing you do? I mean, you're faced with some volumes of sheet music. What do you do? What's the first thing you do? How do you know how to start?
Yeah. The first thing I do is exactly what you're not supposed to do if you're a normal user of a book. I turn a little corner over and kind of dog-ear it, and then I turn it back the other way. And if it falls off, I know the paper is brittle.
Oh, beautiful.
And if paper is not brittle, then, you know, you can still salvage it. I could send it out to be deacidified if it's acidic. And we can get back to that if you want to. And that will, and if I deacidify it, then it won't become brittle, which is great. If it's already brittle, you know, it's kind of too late to deacidify it.
Right.
And it's also too late to try to rebind it, because pretty much anything that you would do in terms of sticking the pages together, they're going to come unstuck because they're already falling apart.
So you're not feeding them into the photocopier.
Oddly enough, that is actually one of the approaches that we've used with brittle music in digitization. Because the paper is already brittle and in many cases is already falling out of the bindings, with a lot of those scores, what we actually did was cut them out of the bindings so that we could scan them using a sheet feed scanner, which is very foolproof. It's the easiest kind of scanner for somebody doing production scanning to use, and it works the fastest.
It's got a document feeder.
It's got a document feeder.
Okay, so you're putting in this rare piece of music.
You got it.
Document jam. Is that
a nightmare?
Is that a recurring nightmare?
Actually, not so much. I looked at it as a prospective nightmare, but we looked pretty carefully at what kind of scanners were on the market, and we chose one that just feeds from above, and it's very gentle, and so it doesn't turn the paper into curlicues.
Ah, okay.
It also has a little blue button on it. And when I was training a new student to use the scanner, I would introduce them first thing to the little blue button. And I said, if you are going along and the sheets are going through the scanner and you hear crinkle, 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 push the little blue button. That's the panic button.
And that's when Alice comes running.
Actually, that's when all the paper just sort of falls through and doesn't. And it's just, the machine immediately lets it go. And usually the result of that crinkle, crinkle is that one of the sheets has gotten some crinkles in it.
Hence the
crinkly noise. And it happens if two sheets didn't get cut apart. So you have two sheets that are trying to
go down
and one of them pulls through and the other one doesn't. We've never had a situation where paper was just destroyed by that happening.
Like what happens regularly, depending upon how urgent the assignment is for other offices, right? The inverse relationship, the more you need to copy something like immediately, the more likely it is for your copier to jam.
Luckily, we didn't have to share our scanners. We got a big grant to do a lot of scanning over about a 5-year period. We scanned about 20,000 volumes, mostly scores.
Okay, but getting back to the beginning of this project, and it was in the 1980s, and technology in terms of that type of technology is completely different now.
Yes.
How did they approach it back then?
There were two approaches. The first of them was microfilming. The two similar approaches where you actually take music and take some kind of image of it.
Mm-hmm.
First of those was microfilming, and it was also not entirely satisfactory for music because you can't really play from a microfilm either, even if you've got a microfilm reader. I mean, can you imagine a string quartet sitting around four microfilm readers? It would be a pain.
I didn't think this was going to be a very funny half hour, but for some reason, everything you're saying is making me laugh.
Oh, yeah. No, this is like I said, my job is really fun. So we did do a certain amount of microfilming, but it was for scores that were mostly for research value, that it would be to the point to look at them in a microfilm reader.
Mm-hmm.
We tried a couple of other different things with scores that you would actually want to perform from. At first, we tried things like encapsulating them in little plastic pouches each page. That was really ugly. We also tried laminating them. You can get sheets of hot melt glue, and you can get translucent nylon web, and we made sandwiches with the nylon web on the outside and then hot melt glue and then your brittle paper, and we had a big press that would heat the glue and it would come out. You could read the music very well it was really durable. I mean, we would like try crumpling these things up and doing all kinds of things that you really can't do with brittle paper. And, you know, they were fine. But they were really thick, which made it hard to bind.
Mm-hmm.
And if anybody wrote in them, even with pencil, erasing was impossible because it's that nylon webby stuff and the eraser would kind of tear through it and it was a mess.
Yeah, yeah, interesting. But is it it sounds like high risk in terms of the lamination process?
No, the process itself wasn't high risk. The heat's not that high, doesn't need to last very long. Of course, it was totally non-reversible. We wouldn't want to do this with, you know, any kind of one unique high artifactual value. You know, we wouldn't do that with something out of the vault.
No.
But on the other hand, during up through into the 80s, it was about all we had if we had a brittle score and somebody really wanted to play it and we really wanted to keep it on the shelf. In the 90s was when we got to the point where toner would stick to paper reliably.
Mm-hmm.
Photocopying became a preservation option in the 90s, which before it hadn't. You know, you think about those old mimeographs and
I can still smell them.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I remember, too, is the smell. And you'll notice if you can still find any of them, they're almost illegible because the purple print fades.
Mm-hmm. Does it still smell?
Yeah. Worse.
Okay. I know what I'm doing this weekend.
Yeah. So anyhow, the photocopying was our first kind of large-scale music reformat project. Some of it we did in-house, just with a good staff photocopy machine that we had already checked that, yes, this had the right kind of toner that we could expect to stick to the paper. And we bought special paper mm-hmm. that was extra heavy. We also did send volumes out to be photocopied. Interestingly, those normally also had to have the spines chopped off, just like the sheet feed scanning that we've done since.
Just to get them flat,
to get them flat enough to get good copies. You could send volumes out to be photocopied, but the result was often not as good as you could get from sheet fed or, you know, from flat.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, everyone has had that experience copying something that way. And, you know, there's as you get closer to the binding, it's like, you know, all of a sudden looks like the cover of Rubber Soul by the Beatles.
Yeah. There are some types of scanners that you don't have to disbind the books, which is nice. We have certain books that I would not disbind, so i.e. not chop off the spines.
So the sensor has an ability to straighten towards the middle, towards where the binding is?
Actually, there are two kinds. There is one kind of machine that has two cameras and a cradle in the middle, and you just open the book onto the cradle, and each camera clicks a picture, and you or the machine turns the page, and each camera clicks another picture. We've used that. It's hard to use because getting the lighting correct is not something that, you know, a student employee can learn in an hour.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, we've also got a kind of scanner that is just like any old paper copier type of scanner, only one edge of the glass
mm-hmm.
is positioned so that it's right at the edge of the scanner.
Ah.
Which is actually a little trickier to accomplish than you'd think. But they
so
get
you're getting the glass so right that, into the binding
yes,
of the book.
Yes, so that you can just drape the book over the edge of the scanner.
All
there
right.
have been a couple of versions of that with photocopiers that I didn't like very much. But this scanner, it's a book scan. Oh, what's it called? Plus Tech, I think, is the... we've really liked.
It sounds labor intensive because I don't envision any automatic document feed
right.
process.
It does not have any automatic document feeding process, and if you've got something that is very fragile, you still have to be quite careful because you're manipulating the book and
over
each time
and
you turn
over
the pages
and over again.
And even though you're not pressing it flat, you are still pressing it onto the platen, so that for very fragile items, you still have to be careful. But you can scan bound volumes and get all the advantages of a really good-looking image.
Great. So you have a lot of different strategies and a lot of different tools at your disposal.
Yeah.
Alice Carley is the conservator at the Sibley Music Library of the Eastman School of Music, University of Rochester, and she is here for the next 10 minutes. If you want to join the show, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-TALK. Getting back to the original, you know, one thing that you do when you go and you've got all these scores that are originals, all over the place. You said, what, like 57% of your, at one point, 57% of your library consisted of original sheet music.
It's all original sheet music. It's not all manuscripts. It was all brittle was the problem. There was a period between about 1850 and about 1950 when pretty much all the paper that was produced was bound to become brittle quickly. If you look at a really old piece of a book or a piece of sheet music before 1850, the paper won't be brittle. It was because people had figured out that if you make paper out of plant material that isn't wood pulp. For instance, if you use cotton or even old rags to make paper, the paper won't become brittle quickly. And in fact, there's still a lot of the scores, the oldest scores in the vault and the oldest books in the vault are less brittle than what was published between, like I say, about 1850 and about 1980 because you will also, if you look at an old book or score, notice that the printing is kind of fuzzy because the paper surface is kind of fuzzy.
Mm-hmm.
About 1850, because it's not ideal, some German paper maker discovered that if you size the paper, and sizing you do to kind of condition the surface of the paper after you've made it. If you size the paper in an acidic bath, you can get it very smooth.
Oh.
And it takes print beautifully, and you get these wonderful, crisp letters. And so all the papermakers adopted it very rapidly around the middle of the 19th century. And over the next 50 years, they realized that over about 50 years, all of that paper becomes brittle.
So, okay, so it's about one issue is the acid. Mm-hmm. And so when you talk about
deacidification.
Yes, thank you very much. I don't say
you
it
you got to be
often.
Very careful saying
deacidification,
that.
Deacidification, yeah, okay, good. And then you say it, I'll just point. Mm-hmm. What's that all about? How does that work? And at what point can't you do it?
Mm-hmm. In deciding whether to deacidify something, first I check to see if it's acidic, and you can get like little testing pens that act like litmus paper, only quicker and easier, and tell you if it's acidic or not. And then if you have something that is acidic and you fold a corner over, say, twice, and it still won't come off even if you pull it, then, hey, that's a ripe for deacidification because it hasn't been much damaged yet.
Mm-hmm.
But if you turn a corner over a couple of times and you can pull it off, you're a little late.
Once it's become brittle, then you're on to the things that we talked about a few minutes ago.
And so what we have in the collections of the library that I mostly deal with, the general collections, it's not like they're manuscripts. They're just printed music. Mm-hmm. Somebody printed a bunch of music and we bought a copy whenever it was that we bought it. And some of those copies are very common and, you can still buy lots of new ones. And all the new ones that we buy aren't acidic. They'll last a long time.
Well, that was the next, an obvious question. What are they doing so that, they'll last a long
time? Yeah. There's a new way, the new way of making paper that was first introduced around 1950, and it took a while to catch on because you have to totally, throw out all your equipment and buy new equipment to do this. But instead of washing the paper with acid, you essentially smush chalk into the surface of the paper, and that's what makes it nice and smooth.
Oh, interesting. So instead of removing, you're filling.
Yes. And that's a really great innovation because the chalk is actually mild base, let's call it that
way.
It will absorb acids. And because certain kinds of paper that's made from wood pulp particularly, has lignin in it. Lignin is sort of like cellulose, only it's more haphazardly made as a molecule. It falls apart in a way that cellulose does not. And when lignin falls apart, it creates acid. which can then attack the cellulose.
But you've got your base in there now,
and so
the deacidification process takes place
exactly
as a byproduct of the manufacture.
Yes.
Oh, wow. This is interesting. So, okay, what's another next step then in terms of – and you wrote the – I want to – what's the name of your book?
Binding and Care of Printed Music.
Yes, and what's the next step? We're talking here, and I'm sort of thinking about it visually. You're in the stacks, you're finding music, and then you're triaging it, if you will. Mm-hmm. And so what are some of the other things that you might do to conserve that music?
Usually I will either fix it if the paper's okay and it's just like ripped up or marked up or something like that, or I'll replace it. If somebody's still printing it and we can buy a new copy, then we'll buy a new copy. And if the old copy is in bad shape or brittle, we'll toss it. However, if it's not in print, obviously, then we're going to replace it by making ourselves a new copy. Copyright comes
in
there.
Yeah, I know. It's like, oh, boy.
A lot of the sort of treasure trove of our music is out of copyright.
So it's going to become more valuable over time. And,
we actually do save the originals. For everything that we can't buy a new copy, we don't throw it away. We do keep it. It's, of course, we've already cut it out of the binding. We store it wrapped up and put it in remote storage in case something happens to our digital copies.
Yeah. Okay. So, and you get the permission of the...
usually, because we're a library, occasionally we will actually ask for permission. But oftentimes we don't have to because we're taking the original out of circulation. We're just doing a one-for-one swap.
That's the exception built into the law there. Fantastic. So much more to talk about. It's very complex, and you're an international expert on this. Alice Carley, Conservator of the Sibley Music Library, Eastman School of Music, U of R. Thank you so much for spending time here on Connections Education Friday.
Thank you. This was a lot of fun.
All right. Ditto. All right. On behalf of John Andrus and the WXXI News Team, I'm Frank Sigelski saying thank you for listening, and you have been listening to Connections Education Friday on WXXI AM and WXXI.org.